This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
Yeah, so I want to add, I'm going to do 2 weeks in a row that I'm doing something 2 weeks in a row, right? So I'm going to go back to the Weinstein thing again, in part because last time we recorded, a lot of the reporting hadn't come out on it yet. So when we recorded last time, only the New York Times story had come out. And since then, we saw the New Yorker story, which interestingly was supposed to be a MSNBC story, but NBC didn't want to touch it. So this is the story by Ronan Farrow, who is the stepson of Woody Allen, the son of Mia Farrow, and the illegitimate son of Frank Sinatra. And so he takes this kind of issues personally because he accused Woody Allen of having molested his sister and then obviously marrying his stepsister or adopted sister. So personal set of issues to him. So, I mean, first of all, the New Yorker story is so much worse than the New York Times story. The New York Times story is basically about quid pro quo sexual harassment, whereas the New Yorker Ronan Farrow story is about rape. And then I was thinking about this, and then, you know, since then there was a story in HuffPo, which was kind of the behind the scenes story of Ronan Farrow's article, talking about how hard it was for him to publish it, that he'd been working on it for years and NBC backed off because they were basically afraid of Weinstein suing them. Even though they fact checked it, they were still afraid of Weinstein. And so he ended up having to take it to the New Yorker, and then The New Yorker is famous for its fact-checking and its lawyers and whatnot. They're also the ones who published Lawrence Wright's story on Scientology, which is a similarly contentious type situation. But just a few days ago, as of this recording, which is 10/18, Harvey Weinstein was kicked out of the Motion Picture Academy, which and then it got me to thinking, and I realized that there's so many ways, and this is almost like Shakespearean, where, first of all, Weinstein's career fundamentally was built on learning how to game the Oscars. You know, that was fundamentally what Miramax did, was you took movies that nobody'd ever heard of, and you campaigned aggressively in ways nobody had ever thought of campaigning for Oscars before, and you got those movies Oscars in order for them to get publicity. And he basically invented the modern conception of Oscar bait and the modern conception of the four-year consideration campaign. And here he is being kicked out of the Academy, which is, you know, kind of like this fitting end for like a, you know, Greek tragedy type thing. But then I was also thinking about it, and I realized that the another irony of it is that if somebody were to make a movie about how Farrow broke this story, it would be the most Oscar bait movie of all time. Because, you know, in my 2014 paper with Schilke, we had all these plot keywords and we coded them for how Oscar worthy they were, or rather the computer coded them. And we didn't give much emphasis to what the specific ones were, but I'm looking at the list right here, specifically the right tail of the list. There's 6,000 of these things, but if I'm looking at the top 40, and I'm just going to go through the top 40 and read the ones that have to do either with show business or with investigative reporting of some kind. Vaudeville.
Great.
Behind the scenes. Political scandal. TV station.
Check.
Sexual favor.
Check.
Evidence tampering.
Check.
Yep. Let's see here. Ethics. Broadway. And there was even a specific Broadway thing in one of the allegations. Television producer, political repression, Watergate, Pulitzer Prize source, and whistleblower. So, I mean, a lot of those keywords, you don't see the exact thing, but, you know, if they seem to load on the same factor, right? They seem to be generically getting at the idea of investigative reporting, sexual scandal, especially involving some type of coercion, and kind of behind the scenes, how the entertainment industry works, all of which are like big Oscar bait. It's not just disabilities, right? Or, you know, war crimes. You also see these things are characteristic of Oscar bait. Basically, another way to think about it is that this is, you know, La La Land meets Spotlight.
Well, it's almost as though what your computer was doing was picking up on all of these gossip items about Harvey Weinstein and then just put them
all into
it wasn't
coding that, right? It was coding the plot keywords of Oscar-winning films or Oscar-nominated films. And so here you have this guy whose entire career is closely identified with the Oscars. And then, you know, it turns out that his downfall, and in particular how Pharaoh very diligently got the story to bring him down, is the kind of thing that would make an even better Oscar movie than anything Weinstein ever produced. And Weinstein can't vote on it because he's kicked out of the Academy now.
Well, what's up with Watergate, though? Like, are there that many Watergate movies, or is it just they all go for gold?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But those, so All the President's Men got a lot of Oscars. I don't remember off the top of my head if there were any other.
That's for our Hollywood episode. We can bracket that one.
Yeah, but what about the fallout of this, right? I've been wondering more and more, you know, is this just more of the same? You know, it's like Harvey Weinstein goes down, you know, a couple more heads roll, and then we forget all about it, and we allow this stuff to go back.
I was thinking about this. This was a learning experience for me after that whole hashtag Me Too thing started going around. And, you know, it's one of those things, as a guy, you know that this stuff happens in the abstract and that it is prevalent. But I was really struck by this Me Too campaign and how much of it I saw around. And I think, even though I understood it was a serious problem, I didn't understand that it was like virtually universal. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how much one episode will change things, but this was definitely.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind too, with the hashtag Me Too campaign, that, I mean, research shows that women who have been sexually assaulted or harassed are like really not, not likely to file reports or to be vocal about it, fearing embarrassment or shame or retaliation. So even though this campaign supposedly was quite liberating and a lot of people saw it popping up in their newsfeed, I mean, we can also estimate that those numbers are much lower than the actual prevalence of women who have been assaulted or harassed. Yeah,
totally. I'm getting the sense that it's virtually everybody
there
now.
There definitely seems to be kind of a safety in numbers thing. You see this specifically with Weinstein and Hollywood in general, than the broader issue, that it's like once people say it, then there's like, you know, the preference falsification or whatever is broken, and people realize that there's ways to say it. I also think it's interesting, like what Joe was saying, is that men can underestimate it. And I see this almost as like a very dark version of the friendship paradox. The friendship paradox is this pretty old model. It goes back like 50 years, that says that if you look at the average number, if you were to survey all your friends and ask them how many friends they have, the mean number of friends for all of your friends would be higher than your number of friends. So mean number of friends per friend is higher than mean number of friends. You know, and the reason being that gregarious people know a lot of non-gregarious people. And so when you kind of sample Pathlink 2, you're picking up those gregarious people. So I see it almost like that, in the sense that, or another way to put it is that if most men most of the time basically are pleasant, but there's a certain number of, you know, scumbags who are ubiquitously scumbags, you know, so it seems like Harvey Weinstein was doing this at least once a week for 20 or 30 years, you know, that kind of almost like power law distribution for scuzziness on the part of men, whether it's, you know, sexual harassment or sexual assault or street harassment or anything along those lines, is going to make it a ubiquitous experience for women, or at least a universal experience, even if it's not a daily occurrence. But something that could be, you know, largely off the radar for most men. And so it could be simultaneously true that most men will be surprised because they're like, I've never done that. How can it be universal? And most women are like, oh, yeah, that happened to me last Tuesday. Precisely because, you know, there's such enormous variance in how much, basically the guys who do it all the time. And that makes it pervasive to women, even if it's rare for men to witness or commit.
Well, now I'm wondering, though, is it that rare, or, you know, because...
No, I don't think it is. So I think there are two different things. I think part of the explanation might be what Gabriel's saying. But I also think, you know, I also think that you need to think about context. And I think there are different places where there are cultures in which I think men don't understand that, you know, that certain kinds of language, you know, certain kinds of behaviors are actually not wanted by women. But because they're part of this culture that says, yeah, it's great, they'll do it, right? And they might end up only doing it once, right? And then understanding, whoa, I totally misunderstood that this isn't something that a woman wants. But then you've already had a woman or a girl affected by your bad behavior.
I think that probably varies depending on what level of behavior you're talking mm-hmm. about. If you're talking about subtle misunderstandings and slights, the kind of thing that is sometimes called microaggressions, then I think most people probably commit it, right? But I think if you're talking about like the really egregious stuff, then I think you probably do have this like, you know, really high variance distribution for how, you know, you have guys like Harvey Weinstein doing it once or twice a week for 30 years. And then, you know, I can personally attest, I've never, you know, demanded that a colleague or a student or whatever watch me shower, you know, or, you know, come massage me or whatever, you know, you know, it's not like I'm just forgetting that one time I did it, you know.
I have a question, though. How is it like if you meet a typical person there, what's the expected probability of them being like predatory? Is it like a coin flip or is it very rare?
You want to take that one, Ash?
Well, I mean, to add nuance to it, that we know, of course, the context matters. So there are some institutions or settings in which predatory male behavior is really rewarded. For instance, fraternities on college campuses, where there is this kind of, you know, deep-seated expectations that women are there as sexual prey to be plied with alcohol, and all kinds of bravado around sexual conquest bolster a man's masculinity. Mm-hmm. So in that context, you know, a Harvey Weinstein-like kind of behavior might make more sense than in other contexts. But you even still would have much more predatory individuals in that context than others.
So. Exactly. I mean, that's the way that I totally see it. It depends on where you are, right? You know, if I'm picking my daughter up from preschool, I don't expect it, right? But, you know, if I don't know, actually a place where you would think that you shouldn't expect it, you do. If I'm on like a crowded subway or metro train, I totally expect that to happen. I totally expect groping and other kinds of like bad behavior.
Jeez. I know. How bad is it in the academy?
You know, Ashley has experience in two different fields that I would expect one of them to be high and one of them to be low on this, like either by word of mouth or whatever. Are you familiar with there being big differences in this sort of thing in modeling versus academia?
Yes, for sure. There's all kinds of heightened opportunities for sexual harassment and assault in fashion, because just the nature of the way that the interactions happen are in, you know, private studios or a photographer's apartments, for instance, where casting calls can happen. So, and you have like extreme inequities between people of age and power. And so you don't quite have that, those kinds of extreme and private encounters in academia. I mean, when you say academia, you mean like among professors or between professors and students?
Well, any respect. Like, you occasionally hear stories. There was just a story about some hard scientist. I forget what type of hard scientist, right, but would it lead like Antarctic expeditions,
yes,
and apparently sexually harass women on the
actually Earth. It happened at my campus is involved in an investigation where someone in earth sciences reportedly was sexually harassing graduate students in the field, and like emphasis on it being in the field, because that's also like an extreme kind of encounter where it seems that the rules might be different. There's more intimacy. There's less of your own space when you're sharing like a camp space, for instance. And so there's like a number of abuses that have been reported, and surprisingly, it's taken like a year for the investigation to very slowly proceed. Yeah, I mean, in fashion, it was just much more ubiquitous. Like, people would talk about these things. Models would talk about unwanted advances. Men and women models would talk about them just as a matter of course, you know, like, watch out for this photographer. You know, everybody knows about, you know, like, one or two.
Well, like, I've heard, like, even I have heard of, like, Terry Richardson.
As
being, like, kind of notorious for, like, quid pro quo sexual harassment.
Yeah, for sure. And that was also part of his art. So he made it, like, an ironic kind of statement that he would be inappropriately gesturing gesturing towards, you know, underage models, and he would take photos of it. And those photos would be celebrated for their authenticity when in fact, they're like, they're really, you know, completely horrifying for someone on the other side.
Oh, charming.
Of it. You know, he's been outed, he's been shamed, but he's still doing his job. Mm-hmm. He took a brief hiatus and now he's back. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think that in academia, I would like to say that there are stronger human resources controls, but that's probably only the case since Title IX has been kind of bolstered under the Obama administration to make investigations more serious, which prior to they weren't. I mean, investigations of cases of abuse of undergrad students and grad students.
And how much of this do you think is kind of the, logistical or opportunity side in that, you know, most of academia takes place in offices and, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, I mean, people do go to conferences, but it's routine that everybody gets their own room or maybe grad students share a room, but they share it with peers, not with their advisor, as compared to academia is notionally focused on, you know, kind of the mind, whereas modeling and that sort of thing is explicitly focused on corporeal aspects.
No, I think that that's a little romanticizing. Yeah. You know, I think that like predatory sexual behavior happens in all kinds of contexts, irrespective of, you know, what supposed to be doing, whether looking at the mind or the body. I mean, if you listen to accounts of female faculty who were getting their PhDs like in the 60s and 70s, they tell pretty egregious stories of being treated, you know, as playthings or as sex objects, and so yeah, I mean, not one to name names, but like for sure, I think that it's the fact in fashion is just I mean, people are just in private spaces more and they're likely to be changing clothes more. And so you might have, you know, a little bit more of like an actual opportunity because of the physical space allows it.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.